This is On the Other Hand. A podcast sponsored by Braver Angels in Arkansas that explores politics and other issues of importance to Arkansans through conversations with community leaders. Stay with us as we talk to another leader in Arkansas who works across differences to get things done and to bring us closer together.
Hello and welcome to On the Other Hand. I'm your host, April Chatham Carpenter, and I'm here today with my co-host, Glenn White. On our podcast, Glenn and I interview community leaders in Arkansas who help work towards solutions across various political or other divides and who in other ways reach across various divisions within our community. So Glenn, tell us who our guest is today.
I'm happy to do so, April. We are pleased today to be speaking with Dr. Robert Richards, who is an assistant professor with the Clinton School of Public Service. So welcome to On the Other Hand, Robert.
Well, I'm delighted to be here. Thank you all.
Good. Well, let's start off. There are probably a lot of people who don't have a really good notion of what the Clinton School of Public Service does and what kind of degree it conveys. So could you tell us a little bit about that first and then your role in the program?
Yes, thank you. And I should say, too, it's wonderful to be with both of you, with whom I've worked for a number of years, and promoting civil discussion of public issues in our community. And I'm happy to help this podcast, which I admire a lot and I've learned a great deal from. So the Clinton School was the first graduate educational institution in the U.S. to offer a public service, a Master of Public Service degree. And President Clinton wanted the school to be different from conventional public administration programs. He wanted the school to train professionals for public service, not just in government, but also in the areas of the nonprofit and the for-profit sector, and then in social entrepreneurship as well. And he wanted students to receive what he calls a real-world education. In addition to classroom learning, he wanted students to have very intensive field experience, field service experiences throughout their entire graduate education. So whereas in most public administration programs in the U.S., students have one field service experience, usually a practicum project in their second year, at the Clinton School, students in the in-person program have three field service experiences, a practicum project in their first year, an international public service project, usually outside the U.S. in the summer between their first and second year, and then a capstone project, which lasts the entirety of their second year.
Okay. Robert, I want to hear more about the field placements here in a moment, but first I just want to make sure we understand your role in the program. Can you tell us briefly about that?
Yes. So I teach a course in communication and civic engagement to the first year students, both in the in-person and online programs. And that covers interpersonal group and interracial communication. It covers instruction and facilitation skills, so students learn how to lead civil discussions. It also covers design of public engagement events, so students learn how to create a public engagement process. And then students learn about communication at the level of the community and the society through looking at ideas like deliberative systems and deliberative networks and the role of the community in communication. And I also teach a course in the legal and ethical dimensions of public service, which covers major principles of ethics and how the law plays a role in enabling public service in a number of societies.
Very good. So you teach a couple of classes. Now, what I'm familiar with, maybe some others are, is that when you're in a graduate faculty situation, you often have some research. Do y'all do significant research into the other things that go on at the Clinton School?
Yes, we do. We do applied research. My area of research is in democratic deliberation, citizen participation and governance. I'm a co-investigator on a project called Participedia, which studies citizen participation and governance all over the world. And with Dr. Park, we have a laboratory called the Open Governance Laboratory, which which studies citizen participation in person and online in a variety of settings. And a number of the public discussion processes that we'll be talking about today, for example, are we host public deliberations in cooperation with the Winthrop Rockefeller Institute, Central Arkansas Library System, and the Clinton School together. We hold public deliberations using the National Issues Forums method, and we often evaluate those processes. We get IRB approval to conduct research on those processes, and through that we've developed a number of important insights, including some that I presented at the National Communication Association a few weeks ago about the people's motivations for participating in and talking in deliberative discussions.
Yeah, and we might hear some about that later, I believe. But in the meantime, going back to the idea of the placements, that your program emphasizes a significant number of real-life experiences and placements for the students. Can you tell us a little more about those field placements, the types of places where they go to get their experiences, you know, how they figure into your curriculum?
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. So our staffer Tiffany Jacob is in charge of our international field placements, and they're of great variety and extremely interesting. So we have students who work with nonprofit organizations in the Andes in Latin America to help evaluate programs there. We have this summer we had two students at UNESCO in Paris. Working with the leaders there to develop a program on interracial dialogue, a global program promoting interracial dialogue to foster improved race relations around the world. We have students working in nonprofit organizations in Europe, in Eastern Europe, for example. We've recently had a student work with a nonprofit organization in Eastern Europe promoting democracy and strengthening democratic processes and citizen participation in democracies to try to shore up democratic systems that that might be under pressure a bit in Central and Eastern Europe. In the U.S., for example, in our practicum project, we have students play a number of roles with a variety of organizations. We've done a number of projects with the city of Little Rock on projects such as the developing an improved transportation plan for the city, improving the participation of women and citizens of color in purchasing from the city and the procurement process. We've had students work with the city to improve racial equity in a number of areas in Central Arkansas. Our students work with a wide variety of nonprofit organizations in Central Arkansas, working on issues of immigration, of homelessness, of improving access to healthcare, of the in education. We've had a number of partnerships with the Little Rock School District in evaluating new programs in helping to design programs and doing strategic planning. So our students work on in a variety of issue areas with a very large number of and variety of organizations at the local level throughout the U.S. and in other countries.
Yeah, I'm impressed by the range, the diversity of options, and kind of being all over the world. That's really cool. What kind of reactions do you get from the places where the Clinton School students go to do their placements? What kind of things have you heard in terms of feedback about their the roles that they play there?
Well, we generally get very positive feedback. In a number of instances, students get when they go on their, for example, their international public service projects, it's very common for students to then be invited back to do their capstone projects with that organization. And then sometimes those organizations hire the students after their experiences. In particular, these organizations tend to really value the program evaluation skills that our students bring. Most of our students take a course in program evaluation in the second semester of their first year, and they receive in-depth training on program evaluation, and many of our partner organizations then ask our students to evaluate a program of theirs as part of their international public service project. And and those organizations keep asking for Clinton School students to participate again and again in these projects. So they're very pleased with our students' performance overall. And in part, I think because our students really help these organizations determine the effectiveness of their programs, but also because our students are also trained in program planning, which is also related to strategic planning, very often our students can really enhance the overall organizational effectiveness of these organizations that they work with by helping to make sure that helping the organizations establish alignment between the organization's goals and then the goals of the programs that they're offering.
So that's a pretty high degree of endorsement when they want the students back, including hiring them. So that's really good. So speaking of hiring, I mean, not just a comprehensive list, but give us some idea of the kinds of jobs or positions that some of the Clinton School students wind up taking on after they graduate. What have you heard about that?
Well, again, that's one of the reasons why I enjoy working at the Clinton School so much, is because it's actually working the way President Clinton wanted it to work. He wanted students to be prepared to work in the for-profit sector, nonprofit sector, governmental sectors, social businesses, and we have placements of our alumni in all of those areas. So, for example, in government service. So, for example, Representative Vivian Flowers from the inaugural class of the Clinton School is a representative in the Arkansas legislature and has been a very prominent and effective political leader for many years there. In the for-profit sector, I would think of Julie Gehrke at the Walmart Corporation, where she's in charge of corporate philanthropy there. So aligned with a philanthropic vision that President Clinton endorses, but doing it from within the for-profit corporation. We also have a number of our alumni at the Walton Family Foundation on the philanthropic side of the organization, and we have a number of student leaders throughout philanthropies throughout the U.S. Philanthropy is a centerpiece of the Clinton School's programming. Dr. Charlotte Williams runs the Center on Community Philanthropy, which emphasizes grassroots forms of giving, and she offers a course in philanthropy and nonprofit leadership, which is very popular among our students. So many of our students come out very well prepared to lead foundations as well as nonprofit organizations. We have a number of nonprofit leaders in our among our alumni. I just think of Jacob Arnold, who runs the Veterans Future Foundation, in Northwestern Arkansas, and a number of other nonprofit leaders throughout the U.S. And then we have social entrepreneurs. So I think of Reed Admire, who is a social entrepreneur in Central Arkansas. He runs a social business that promotes composting, and that has been an important feature of promoting sustainable development in Central Arkansas for a number of years. We have other alumni who are in government. I think of Maria Calderon, who's one of our alumni, who's a staffer at the U.S. Senate. So it's a very wide variety of our alumni operating in the for-profit, nonprofit, governmental sector, and in social business. I think really putting into practice throughout the whole society the principles that they've learned at the Clinton School.
Yeah, it's really impressive, all the places that they've gone to, and they're starting to have an impact, I'm sure, that they will in the years to come. I'm curious about one thing. I've had a chance over the last few years to meet several of the folks who've gone through the program. There are a lot of atypical students, you know, people who've already had significant careers that go, and younger folks as well. Any observations or trends that you've noticed about the demographics of who's attracted to the Clinton School, nationalities, political background? What have you noticed?
Well, one thing I like about the Clinton School is that the great diversity of the student body. So we have students come from a very wide range of undergraduate institutions and regions and backgrounds. And so we have many students from the South, but a number of students from other regions of the United States, and then increasingly we're having a substantial share of our classes consist of students from outside the U.S. And so there's a strong international pattern within our classroom discussion. So we keep We constantly frame our classroom discussions in terms of the global perspective. Again, consistent with President Clinton's and Secretary Clinton's vision, their commitment to international service as well as service in the U.S. So we have it's really fascinating, particularly in our communication course, where we're encouraging students to engage in perspective taking. And the students in the classroom are they often encounter points of view from different areas of U.S. society or from abroad that they've never encountered before, and it really enriches and deepens the educational experience. Students really expand their horizons when they come to the Clinton School, both through their field placement experiences, but also by interacting with such a variety of fellow students.
That's amazing, and I know how much that makes a difference when you're teaching in the classroom and have different perspectives being heard. So, Robert, I've known you for a while, and I actually have never asked you this question, but I'm curious, since you work on so many initiatives and the classes that you teach, but also the projects that you were just referring to that students are involved in, so many of them relate to this. Promotion of civil conversations in the public square, working across divides. How did you get interested in doing this type of work, to begin with?
Well, I love telling this story, and thank you for asking me that, April. I remember the first time Christy Standifer asked me this question, we realized at that time that we had a personal connection that we hadn't realized. Years ago, I lived in Colorado, and I was living in Boulder, Colorado, working at the University of Colorado. And I went to a little congregational church in Boulder, and it turned out that my congressman was also a member of my church. His name was David Skaggs. He's now a prominent lawyer. And David liked to come home from Washington twice a month to sing in the choir and to teach adult Sunday school, which is it's a feature of congregational life. So I went to, and I like to go to adult Sunday school, so I would hear David sing in the choir. He had a lovely voice. And then I went to his a couple of his adult Sunday school sessions. And it turns out that he was promoting civility in Congress. And this is during the middle and late 1990s when, I guess in the last generation, that was the last time, or the first time within the last generation, that civility really broke down in Congress, after the Contract with America became a dominant theme in the House. And so David was friends with Daniel Yankelevich, the pollster and political scientist. Daniel Yankelevich worked with David Matthews to develop the National Issues Forum's method of citizen deliberation that we're familiar with. And David Skaggs observed this rapid deterioration of civility in the House of Representatives and went and talked with Daniel Yankelevich about it. And then he said, why don't you work with Kathleen Hall Jamieson, and we'll work together and we'll design a discussion method among members of Congress to try to get them talking across the aisle in a civil way. And they designed a series of deliberative discussions in the format or in the context of retreats. And they went on, a number of members of Congress during the late 1990s and early 2000s went on retreats to a retreat center in Hershey, Pennsylvania. They're called the Hershey Retreats, the Hershey Congressional Retreats. And they used methods of deliberation, which are very similar to those used by the National Issues Forums Institute and the Kettering Foundation, to foster civil discussion and cross-partisan deliberation among members of Congress. And that was where I was introduced to the National Issues Forum's method of deliberation, as David described these congressional deliberative dialogues that he had designed with Daniel Yankelevich, who had with David Matthews, designed the National Issues Forum's method of deliberation. And then years later, when I was doing my PhD work, I got a chance to work with John Gastel, who had been an intern at the Kettering Foundation, and then I reconnected with this method of deliberative discussion, and that's the story.
Well, that's a great story. I recognize the Kathleen Hall Jamieson name, certainly a big person in the communication field that has done a lot of work over the years with political communication. So interesting. So at that point, when you first met him, were you an academician?
No, I was a librarian. I was working at the law library at the University of Colorado. And the reason I mentioned Christy Standifer, Professor Christy Standifer is an important dialogue and deliberation scholar, is that at the time she was a graduate student at University of Colorado at Boulder, where I was working in a different part of the university. And so while I was learning about democratic deliberation from David Skaggs, Christy was doing her graduate work in democratic deliberation and dialogue on the same campus. But we reconnected years later at the Clinton School. So.
Christy's a wonderful person. She actually has taught classes in my department at UA Little Rock, and has a great connection, I know, with the university community here. Well, you've mentioned, as you've been talking, the National Issues Forum. You just mentioned Kettering Foundation. I know that your work that you do with the Clinton School and your own research, it pulls from many different bridge-building perspectives. And I recognize that our viewers, although you and I maybe have this common language for many of them, don't know necessarily what those, what bridge-building is, first of all, but also they don't know necessarily some of these bridge-building perspectives that you might be pulling from. And I thought maybe you might tell us a little bit about that. The National Issues Forum, for example, I know you've also been connected with Essential Partners, which was formerly the Public Conversations Project. So if you could tell us a couple of these, maybe that help ground your work a little bit.
Yeah, thank you. So you mentioned Essential Partners. So this used to be called the Public Conversations Project, as you mentioned. And these were a bunch of family therapists in the Cambridge, Massachusetts area who were very good at using highly structured dialogue techniques to help families who were having substantial difficulties change the way they were interacting with one another to improve their relations. They observed intensive conflict in the Cambridge, Massachusetts area in the late 1990s or the late 1980s over the issue of abortion. And they realized, well, these people in our community who are involved in intensive conflict over the issue of abortion, they're acting like our dysfunctional families that we treat in our practices. Why don't we try to take some of our dialogue techniques that we know are effective for our families and see if we can apply them to this conflict in our community? And they did. They invited leaders from both sides of the abortion debate to participate in highly structured dialogues, and it worked. There were people on both sides of the abortion debate in the Cambridge, Massachusetts area who previously were not speaking to one another, who became friends and healed their relationship. Even though they maintained differences, they learned how to communicate about the issue in a constructive manner, and how to show respect for one another's opinions over a period in which, using the structured dialogue method, they were able to heal their relationships. So we teach personnel from Essential Partners teach our students at the Clinton School this technique of structured dialogue, and that they use it in a number of different contexts. And then I provide them with opportunities to put those principles of dialogue into practice. Another influence on us is, as you said, the National Issues Forums Institute method of structured deliberation, which Daniel Yankelevich, as I mentioned earlier, developed with David Matthews in the late 1970s and early 1980s. And in this method, members of the community who disagree on an issue are brought together, invited to participate in a deliberative dialogue with a facilitator and ground rules, and then a carefully designed briefing booklet that presents balanced information about the issue, but then presents the policy choices, not in terms of a binary choice between two options, but in terms of a more nuanced choice among three different policy options, each of which is presented with its both its advantages and then its drawbacks, so that participants basically are invited to weigh the pros and cons and the advantages and trade-offs of each option. The combination of the procedures and the facilitator and the balanced briefing materials with multiple options enables participants to achieve a depth of discussion and a complexity of discussion that they often can't achieve in our ordinary polarized political environment. And your organization, April and Glenn, Braver Angels, offers a similar perspective. In our experience, we partnered with you in the past several years to enable our students to receive training in as Braver Angels moderators, and also to experience Braver Angels events, particularly those involving perspective taking regarding members of different political ideological groups. So I guess another strand that's important here is, in terms of bridge building, is interracial dialogue. So we use Mark Orby and Tina Harris's Interracial Dialogue textbook in our course to help students learn about perspective taking vis-a-vis members of other racial and ethnic groups, and then teach them methods of structured dialogue to enable them to have civil discussions of challenging racial issues. And then students get a chance to implement those principles using the coming to the table interracial dialogue procedures. We work with the organization Coming to the Table to hold a number of interracial dialogues throughout the year, which our students facilitate. So I think all of those methods are ways that our students get experience with building bridges and engaging in perspective taking vis-a-vis people of different groups, ideological, racial, ethnic, cultural groups, and then members of people who are on opposite sides of a conflict.
So I'm going to ask you to define a couple of things here. First of all, the last thing you just mentioned was perspective taking. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, in perspective taking, and this is partly your area of expertise. I'm a sojourner in your area.
It's okay. I know what I mean by it. I know what I mean by it, but I don't know for sure what you mean by it. So
what I mean by it is using our imagination to place ourselves in the shoes, the position of another person, to see the world, to see a situation or a communication interaction, for example, or a conflict or another kind of setting from the perspective of the other person, and then to adjust our communication so that we're interacting with the other person in using symbols and using words and using nonverbal forms of communication that would be acceptable to the other party. In our course, we emphasize principles of perspective taking through interpersonal communication, interracial communication, in conflict resolution, and dialogue and deliberation. And we find that that's and again, one of the reasons we do this is because President Clinton places such a powerful emphasis on this in his own advising work. If anybody has a conversation with him that involves any public issue, one of the first things he starts talking about is, well, are the parties involved in this manner, are they really seeing the situation from the point of view of the other person? Because he's found through his career that engaging in perspective taking is essential to developing effective policies and also communicating effectively about public issues to members of different groups in the society. So perspective taking is really essential to our approach to communication and our approach to public engagement.
That makes sense. Well, I know that one of the organizations that brings together academics and practitioners doing this type of work is the National Coalition of Dialogue and Deliberation. And on their website, to oftentimes bring this into my classes, to try to distinguish between debate, dialogue, and deliberation. You've used the two terms dialogue and deliberation quite a bit as you've been talking about the foundation of your work. How do you define or see the differences between what happens in like a structured dialogue, for example, or in a deliberation?
Well, thanks for that question. I just came from a conference at the University of Delaware at the Biden School, where Lori Britt, who's the chair of the board of the National Coalition for Dialogue and Deliberation, was present, and we talked a good deal there. She's a good colleague of mine. We talked about dialogue and deliberation extensively during that discussion about how to promote civil discourse throughout the U.S. So the terms that, as we use them, at the Clinton School are similar to those that our colleagues use throughout the country. So dialogue, our goal, our main goal really is mutual understanding. We want to have a structured interaction with others in the hopes of achieving a new level of understanding of where the other person is, how they perceive the world, what their experiences are, in the hopes of fostering a more constructive relationship. Whereas in deliberation, our focus is on decision making. And sometimes that's coming to a decision about a particular policy or a course of action. And sometimes it's about getting a clearer sense of what our views are, what our attitudes are about policies. That's generally how we draw the distinction. And so it's very common in a dialogue situation not to talk about action or decision making at all. And in many, many dialogue settings, we don't talk about policies, the possibilities for courses of action at all. We can have dialogues about an issue without focusing on what we should be doing about the matter. When we hold dialogues about issues, very often we're more concerned about what are people's experiences with this issue, what does it mean to them, what are the values that they associate with it. How is it impacting their lives? How are they interpreting the world in light of that issue? And how does that implicate us? Whereas in deliberation, we're very often focused on to what extent is there common ground among the people who are having the discussion, so we can develop some common understandings of the nature of the problem, some preferred courses of action, and how we might act together to try to implement those policies in the world. So that's the basic approach that we take.
Okay, thank you. The examples that you gave at the beginning of when we started this interview were of some things that you do with the Clinton School, and it sounds like your students do both of those kinds of processes. Both dialogue and deliberation. So coming to the table, you've mentioned, is more dialogue, but deliberation has to do with more of the decision making. So some of the people who are doing more activist work in terms of getting people together in the community to come together on education things, for example, or access, would be doing more deliberation.
Right, right. Just for example, we just held a series of public dialogues about the housing issue. In Arkansas, that our students facilitated a number of discussions about housing, and there were a number of those discussions in which participants they exchanged contact information, and they wanted to continue the discussion because they had some ideas in common, and talked about following through to try to take some action on some of the topics that they had discussed. Deliberative conversations. Yeah.
So you kind of go back and forth a lot of times, it sounds like.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
One of the things that goes to my mind when I'm hearing you talk about this, your students then clearly get a good exposure to the kind of things that I know April is real familiar with and works on. But I'm hopeful some of them, I believe, are going to be involved in at least observing some of our civil conversation series that we'll be doing in the coming year. And it's primarily a dialogue kind of thing using some communication skills. So I'm interested in hearing their perspectives as they observe that structure we've created and see if they have any ideas or tweaks that could improve it. So I'm looking forward to having that conversation with some of your students. So moving on to another thing, one of the thoughts that occurred to me, you mentioned getting more international students recently. And so I wonder, you know, we've got a lot going on. There's a lot going on all over the world. But in this country in particular, we've reached a really potentially difficult and problematic time in our culture and in our politics and the political climate. Your international students, I know, have some differing experiences in their culture and coming from different governmental traditions. I wonder if you've heard anything yet about any of the international students, what their reaction is once they've come here and observed what's going on in this country. Any perspectives or reactions you've heard from them that might be interesting to hear, kind of coming from an outsider, if you will?
Yeah, thanks for that question, Glenn. So I guess one thing that's interested me is the commonalities. So even though there are a number of differences, and I'll describe this a little bit in a moment, there have been a number of commonalities, in particular since our democracy here in the U.S. has come under pressure in recent years. So now, I mean, essentially we had a coup attempt in 2021 in the U.S., and but a number of our students come from, or a number of our international students come from countries that have had coup attempts, and they've lived through that experience, and they've sometimes they've seen their democracies vanish, and sometimes they've seen their democracies withstand the pressure of an attempted coup or a successful coup. So this is particularly true of our students from Latin America and from Africa who have lived through intervals between democratic and authoritarian rule. So in a way, and that helps the students from the U.S. see that maybe that's a respect in which the U.S. is not so different from other countries, that many other countries in the world have democracies that are somewhat unstable, and they move back and forth between more democratic and more authoritarian forms of rule. I guess another point of commonality is that a number of societies that our international students come from also have very strong divides, oftentimes along lines of ethnicity or region. And so even though they don't have exactly the same kind of partisan polarization that we have in the U.S., or they may not have exactly the history of fraught race relations as we do in the U.S., they're often quite familiar with polarization along various lines. And so the techniques that we use that April and I just talked about for constructively dealing with polarization in society, they find very useful, because they find that those techniques are helpful in addressing the polarized conflicts within their own societies. Yeah.
Well, Glenn, we've had a wonderful first part of our conversation with Robert Richards, but we have so much more to talk about. So we're going to save some of this for the second part of our conversation with Robert, and that will be in our next episode.
Thanks for joining us on today's edition of On the Other Hand, the first part of our conversation with Robert Richards. Be sure to check out the second part of this conversation with Robert, as well as other podcast episodes of On the Other Hand. You can find us on the podcast page of the Braver Angels Arkansas website at arkansas.braverangels.org or on many popular podcast sites.
And when you visit our website, in addition to links to all of our episodes, you'll also find a link to email us, and that is at otherhandar@gmail.com. And feel free to send us your program feedback or suggested speakers.
On the Other Hand is sponsored by Braver Angels in Arkansas. Music was composed by Randall Standridge of Jonesboro, Arkansas, and was performed by the University of Northern Colorado Symphonic Band, Dr. Richard Main, conductor.
From your host, April Chatham Carpenter.
And Glenn White.
Let's each do our part to bring our community closer together.